Another point that we would like to share you see, meditation is more about being than doing. One learns all these techniques and methods of meditation, but they are tools that by nature are senseless. But our ego grasping tends to solidify everything, even the spiritual method, even the teachings. So it's more about there are tools there, but they help us to uncover our own pure nature that is already there, hidden below the clouds of confusion, the clouds of agitation. You see, we meditate on love, but the point is to become love, to become compassion, to become emptiness. There's no me that becomes patient. We have to be patient. And as you let go of all these graspings, attachment to concept, ideas, you discover, you see in the silence of your own mind, contentment, joy. It's there within you. So the methods, one has to be careful not to solidify them too much and to become a busybody Dharma practitioner. You know, one brings the same attitude in our spiritual practice that we have in one's worldly activity. So one has to do one's spiritual practice in a gentle, casual way, you know, a little bit like a game, like the playful. One has to be playful and joyous and relaxed. Because they are just tools to help you to discover your own pure mind. But for it to work, you have to, you know, be gentle, kind with yourself, relaxed, joyful, and to listen inside. You see, how to say, the outer teachers, they can only help you so much. They can just guide you to your own inner wisdom. At some point, you see, they say at the beginning you rely on the outer teacher. And then you rely on the text. In the middle you rely on the text, what the scripture says. And at the end you rely on your own wisdom, on your own experience. So sometimes people develop a kind of dependency towards the teacher. You know, that's not healthy. You know, the teacher are there to share. You know, at the beginning of the path, we really need that. Because we don't know. how to go about it. But as the year passes, if you're still completely dependent on the person of the teacher, then that's not a sign of spiritual growth, you know. One should still completely respect and ask advice, but in terms from one's own inner practice, you start relying, you know, on what the teacher says, points to the text you have studied, so the answer are found there in the texts. You know? And then as you make experience, you know how long you need to meditate on this, on that. You know the whole path, right? So you know where you're weak, what's your forte. So, you see. So it's important to develop this inner confidence. You see? That's very important. And also to gain some satisfaction in your spiritual practice. So to get satisfaction, you see, if you're busybody going to your practice and you never still and you never contemplate, you never just be, then you have the same restless mind in your spiritual practice than you have in everyday life. So it's good to do your practice, your prayers or your meditation. And from time to time you just stop and contemplate and rest and feel. And let your inner wisdom, you see, shine forth. Okay, so for 20 minutes we're going to just sit like that. So please start with any object you enjoy, object of meditation. As you see, it's more like a post on which you always bring back your mind, you know, it's the post. And then, how to say, we all have this good inner nature, this inner kindness, you know, this inner wish for, yeah, one wants to be happy and wishes the best for everyone. No? So let this, you know, pureness in you, you know, shine forth. No? And you see, the more your mind becomes silence, the more you have contentment. Why do we want this and that pleasure out there? No, because one's mind is unsatisfied, doesn't have contentment. So, you know, we look for contentment in outer sense pleasure. But if you have contentment inside, if you have satisfaction inside, you know, you have peace, inner light, inner love, contentment. It's like, you just feel happy to be. You don't need to be doing anything to be happy. Just to be, you're happy. Just the fact, you see, one of the greatest wonderment in life is just the fact that we exist. And when you sit there with a silent mind, you're so happy just to be. So it's the restless mind that is unsatisfied, that always looks for more, for something different. But the peaceful mind, the settled mind, is happy. And in that inner stillness, you see, you can inquire into the nature of things, how things really exist, who am I? And from that inner stillness, love and compassion and bodhicitta comes very easily. So much of the path is about letting go. You see, letting go of our thoughts, of our emotion, of our concern about this and that. That's why for calm abiding, you know, the mind of non-attachment is very important. Is that non-attachment doesn't mean indifference. Often we mistake understanding. Oh, it speaks about non-attachment. It means that we become indifferent. It's not true at all. We can be concerned and non-attached. We can have love and compassion and not being attached. We can be doing things and letting go at the same time. You see, it's not meditating on stillness, it's becoming still, it's being still. And that implies letting go of one's attachment to thoughts, to emotion, to concerns. You let go because you know it's senseless and it's endless. One thought leads to the next, and it's endless. There's no peace there. You let go because you know it's transparent. These thoughts, emotions have no essence. And once you see completely their essencelessness, you can use them again and they don't affect you. You can remain in this inner stillness and peace while using thoughts and emotion and being in the world. It doesn't affect you. Because you see everything as transparent, as senselessness. So everything has the same nature. And in that is always peace. So we sit with that for 20 minutes. when we try to sit still like that, to be the mind, they might have thoughts that arise and emotions. It's the nature of the mind to have thoughts and emotions. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem arises that we solidify these thoughts and these emotions. We give them a reality that they don't have. In reality, these thoughts and emotions are essenceless. Again, one has to, it's a word, essenceless. What does it mean experientially? How can I experience the essencelessness of my thoughts, of my emotion, of my mind? So if they had the concrete existence that they seem to have, and as you sit here trying to be peacefully rested, there are thoughts, mental image, sense of I that hypnotizes you. They grasp your attention, the attention of the mind, as if they solidly existed, as they were real. But if they were real as they appear, the closer you come to them, the more you would investigate, the clearer their solidity would appear. Like, for example, you walk outside and there's a lake there. So the closer you come to the lake, the more it confirms its existence as a solid body of water. However, when you stay still and you investigate your thoughts, your emotion, your sense of I, the more you investigate, the more you look deeply into it, trying to find where they are, how they actually exist. It becomes more and more fuzzy, transparent, non-finding nature. Little bit like a mirage that is seen as water from afar. The closer you come, the less you find water. So that's exactly what happens when you sit still and you inquire, where is that thought? Where does it come from? What's the nature of that emotion? Where is this sense of I? And where is the mind? Like a mirage, the more you inquire, the less you find. And that non-finding makes you discover something incredibly beautiful. An otherness, another way of things, how they exist. Things are like magic. They exist and they don't exist at the same time. And and it's the non-existence of it that makes you free. You see, there's no problem with thoughts, emotion and sense of I. The problem is we solidify it. We don't realize that they are senseless in their deepest nature. So we reify them and we give them an existence that they don't have. And based on this hallucination, cyclic existence function. Liberation is merely seeing the transparent, essenceless nature of everything. And one starts with the thoughts, the emotion and the sense of I and the mind. And tries to taste that essencelessness. First taste it and then becoming it, soaking oneself into it, resting in that space of essencelessness. And if you can soak yourself in that essencelessness, become essencelessness, within that you see thoughts, emotions, sense of I, and your life situation like rainbow. It still exists as dependent arising, but it is essenceless. So all the emotion attachment, aversion, pride, jealousy, all this gradually fades away. All your worry is based on solidifying things, solidifying problems. In reality, the more you see them as a senseless, in a senselessness, there's peace, there's bliss, there's joy, there's light. And nothing makes a senselessness more better or worse. Everything is as it is already. In a senselessness, there's no fear, there's no longing, you are at home. In the ultimate nature of who you are. And that is true peace. And then you look at your life situation from that perspective. Things still exist as dependent arising, but they are empty. So the empty side takes away the drama, the emotion. Everything is seen as a single taste of bliss and a senselessness. Everything is beautiful as dependent arising. And your reason to be in the world is to be helpful for others. For yourself, you have this bliss of the mind within you. You don't need anything. Of course, we have such a familiarity with seeing things as solid that as soon as you forget to see things as senseless, as empty, spontaneously things arise again as solid. So it needs a lot of mindfulness and practice again and again as seeing things as empty, as a senseless. Because we have beginningless habit of seeing things as solid. So a few hours of meditation on a senselessness has no weight compared to this beginningless habit. So you have to soak yourself again and again into a senselessness, into the pure ultimate nature of your mind. And to do so, you need a certain level of mental stability. That's why you need to train in calm abiding. Otherwise, the mind is simply too scattered to even being able to find emptiness and able to remain in it. And in order to train in calm abiding, you need a disciplined life. So you have to put order in your life. You have to simplify your life. You have to find space for meditation. And you start by putting in order your life, gain control over your activities, your speech, and then gradually you take care of your mind. It's not difficult, it's not complicated. It's just not our priority in life. We think it's only for the monks and nuns and the yogis, the hermits. It's not true. Everybody can do it. Okay, a few questions.
Hello. When I was doing the visualization, I was looking from here up, shoulders up. It ended up.
You mean front visualization or
front,
south?
Front visualization.
Yes.
Is there a reason not to do that? Is it better to do the entire Buddha?
Why were you doing that?
I started with the entire Buddha, mm-hmm. and that worked. However, I was so drawn to the face
mm-hmm.
and the shoulders
mm-hmm.
that, and I can see that better from here.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I did that.
Okay. I think it's okay to start like that, but at some point I think it's good to visualize the whole Buddha, because you might create the imprint of being born with only half a body.
Good point. May I ask?
Or only see half a Buddha in the future.
May I ask a follow-up? I had water associated with it. Not that I was focusing on the water, but that it was there.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was a thought that bubbled up, I could deal with it, or I was thinking of sky and clouds and dealing with it. Is that something that I could do at the beginning?
Yes, that's very good. You can do like that. You can use these images, yes.
And then eventually that would go.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's very helpful. That's why these images are given, is because they convey something that's close to the experience, and they help us find in the mind, you know, what we're talking about, yeah.
I have a question. So thinking of that, I wanted to ask you, I've actually used the picture of His Holiness behind you for
years. Yes.
And it's just the head, so
yes.
I've already been practicing with it for a long time. Do I
yeah.
have to change? Or do I?
I
mean, I understand what you're saying, but we should get the whole body.
Finally, yes, but you can actually develop, you see, you can develop calm abiding on the head, and then once you have calm abiding, you add the body.
See that picture? That's a whole new way to look at it.
Yeah. But you see, in that context, that's why they say, if you buy a statue of the Buddha, you know, some statue only have, you know, the head and things. So it's not considered very good, you know. It's bad. You know, sometimes you have lamps with a, you know, a lamp on top of a, you know. So it's not so good. So that's why also sometimes in pictures, you know, we cut pictures. And then if you cut a knee or, a, you know, a part of the body is not considered so good. So you should try to have the whole body in the image, you know.
Mm-hmm. So when you are looking for the space in between thoughts, that when the thought is, you're trying to reach the where the thought starts.
Yes.
You can actually get a glimpse of a gap in between thoughts.
Yes.
But then all of a sudden there's like a groundless sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no footing.
Yes.
And in that sensation, there is like an immediate grasping of something, looking for another thing to grasp on.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like thoughts start arising faster, so you don't have that space. So
mm-hmm.
What do you do about that groundless sensation? It kind of has a, if you were to tint it, it has a little fear in it.
Yes. You have to let go. So jump. You know, being a base jumper, you know, you just dive into it. You know. What are you afraid of? You know, you cannot die in there, right? Whereas the base jumper might, you know, die. But you just plunge into it and see what happens. You know, but it's true what you say. You see, the ego grasping wants to hold on to. It's just its habit, you know. It needs something to hold on to, but just say, you know, boom. But just try, you know. What do you risk, you know? But it's true, the habit is there, you know, he wants to hold, but just let go, you know. Think, you know, remember, you know, that's the way to go. Just let go, you know, just, what do you have to lose? You know, just relax. Yeah, it's true, a good experience.
Earlier today, I used breathing
mm-hmm.
as the object.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we make a commitment at the beginning, you know, that I'm going to focus on the breath.
Yes.
I found that I have a tendency to forget about that commitment.
Yes.
As we go along.
Yes.
So what I did today, you know, some in the past, is on the breath out, during that hesitation, I recommit.
Yes.
It's not really verbal because I don't have enough time to say it in my head
mm-hmm.
before I breathe back
mm-hmm.
in. But I renew the commitment,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and it helps me.
Yes.
So it's like one in and out at a time.
Yes.
But I was wondering, is this something good, or is this a situation where I'm trying too hard?
No, it depends, you see. I think at some point that's good. At the beginning it's good, you know, because this would help you to get to the third level. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, you know. So it helps you to get to the third level. You know, to have one part of the mind that stays on the object. And then you will reach a point where you will develop the habit of actually being there, and you can let go of the thought and you still remain there. You know, so it's a helpful crutch, you know, at certain point, and then at some point you will realize that actually you can let go of that thought and still remain. So it's okay. So at the beginning, you see, how to say, we are in a situation that, you see, these are the tools for developing calm abiding, right? You know, you kind of stick by it, right? But sometimes our calm abiding meditation turns into another meditation. Like, you know, suddenly you let go of your object and you just rest there, and, you know, it becomes another meditation because you have forgotten the object you are supposed to focus on, but you still enjoy sitting there, you know, and if you don't space out, it's still, you know, you might still gain something out of it, right? So it's good. But in terms of training of calm abiding, you have lost it, right? Because calm abiding means you're able to decide, I'm staying on that object, and you can stay there without any excitement thinking, and you reach a point where effortlessly you can stay for hours and days in that object, you know. That's when you reach the ninth stage or full calm abiding. Basically, you know, at the beginning you put on the object, you know, and you stay there forever. For example, there's that story, you know, of that the two friends from Eastern Tibet went on pilgrimage to Lhasa, you know. And just before reaching Lhasa, they stopped to make a cup of tea. You know, so one was making the tea, you know, building the fire, putting the pot, you know, what. That's okay. I'm going to do some meditation while you make tea. You know, so he was making the tea, you know, and was ready, and he sees his friends meditating, you know. I said, well, he meditates, so I have my tea, you know. So he finished his tea, and the friend still meditates. Oh, you know, I'm going on my pilgrimage to Lhasa, and I'm going to visit my friend. So he's going to Lhasa, and he visits his teacher and says, so do you came alone? No, I came with a friend, you know. And he explains the story. Oh, we stopped for tea just before Lhasa, and, you know, I was making tea for us, and he was saying he was going to meditate, and, you know, went to meditation. And he says, well, you should go back to him and say tea is ready, because he's waiting for that, you know. And effectively he went back, you know, and the guy was still meditating, because he had made the decision while entering into meditation, I'll come out of it when I hear tea is ready, right? So that's why and nobody said tea is ready, so he was still in samadhi, right? So that's why when you enter meditation in advanced stage, you have to say, that's why you at the beginning make the determination, I'm going to meditate that much time, right? So for example, myself, when I say I meditate 1 hour, you know, after 59 minutes, my meditation falls apart by itself. It's very strange. You know, I can be in meditation, you know, I decide 1 hour, then 59 minutes, somehow the meditation mind crumbles, you know? It's very strange. So like that you put, I'm going to meditate 5 hours, you know? And then after four hours 59, you know, suddenly you come out, you know? But if you don't make, you know, you end up like these yogis in the caves, which have nails that go around their bodies, you know, and the hair keep on growing because they are samadhi for years. You know, it happens. No? So be careful, you know, you might end up in samadhi. I don't think we have that problem. Not yet, at least.
It's on. So, when I was doing the meditation and using the image of the Buddha behind you, you know, at one point, like behind my eyes, it just went completely like bright yellow, like the sun just shone completely in my eyes. Mm-hmm. The image was completely gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was trying to get it back. I just could not get it back. Mm-hmm. So I opened my eyes to reconnect with the image. Mm-hmm. That I don't know if that's the right thing to do. It was like a physical sensation of bright yellow light, and it was gone.
Mm-hmm. So when you train in karma budding, there are many old things like that happening, you know. So no problem, you know, just look at the image for a while and you start again, you know. Sometimes it's also the light, you know, because you might be sitting close to that, so you have that light, so you have this, you know, feeling of lightness. So there's many things. Also sometimes when you meditate in karma budding, you know, you feel like you sit like that. But actually, you are like that, but, you know, you feel like that, no? Or sometimes, you know, you feel sitting like that, you know. So there's many odd physical or mental sensation as your body, you see as the energy of your body and mind. Because basically, normally, our energy in the body is completely, you know, going all over the place. When you do calm abiding, somehow all the energy of your body gets realigned. You know, so all the energy gets like that, you know, kind of like that. And also in your mind, as the mind stirs up, the mind, some adjustment happens in the mind, from a scattered mind to a calm mind, you know. So there's side effects like that happen, you know. Kind of. So one, usually one is advised just not to pay attention and to continue. You know. Definitely. I mean, here you see, it's not your home situation, right? So at home you would have a picture in front of you, you know, look at it, and then meditate on it. And then when you completely lose it, you would look at the picture again. So the reliance on the image, one has to be careful not to rely too much, just to learn, because basically one tries to build it up with one's mental skill. You know, oh, here's the head, the arm, you know, kind of like that. So this is just to learn how it looks. It doesn't necessarily has to have, you know, exactly like the picture. You know, so you build it with your mind, you know, kind of like that. So you learn it from the pictures, but then, you know, try to hold it. Yeah. I think it's a question. You see, it's better to do many short sessions. So let's say, you know, you look at the picture and then you try to build up for 5 minutes. Then you relax a bit, you look at the picture again and you do for 5 minutes. So you do many short sessions. And then when you can keep it, you know, for 5 minutes, then slowly you extend it, you know. So like that you don't get tired, because if you do and you want to hold it for 20 minutes, you know, it's tiring. It's kind of a new type of doing things that the mind is not acquainted to, and it might create tension and stress, you know. So keep it light, you know, it works better. And also the thing important with calm abiding is to do every day. So it's like physical exercise, you know. It works if you do half hour every day, you know, then it grows. But if you do 3 days and then not 3 days and again 3 days and not 3 days, it doesn't work. So same thing with calm abiding. Better 10 minutes every day than 2 hours one day and then not for the rest of the week. So every day 10 minutes, you know, and then gradually it builds up, you know. So therefore, you see, the basis is a disciplined life, you know. So if you train in calm abiding, you know, going to discotheque at night or at concert and expecting to have a good shine next morning, difficult, you know. So you see, one has to have a certain lifestyle. Then you really make progress. But if you have extreme behavior, you know, or activities, then it becomes an obstacle to, you know, to cultivate that. No, that's the challenge between our modern life and, you know, leisure engagement and wanting to cultivate that. You know, so yeah, that's the challenge.
Mm-hmm. When you said not to use your eye consciousness while mm-hmm. you were visualizing, then I realized that I think I do that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when trying to visualize something in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I think because my eyes, that's what
yes, I'm yes, to use yes.
So I can think about it and an image kind of appears, and then I tell myself it's in my, you know, mm-hmm. not out here.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I didn't know if there's any particular ways to try to not use.
So first of all, as I explained, you know, you know whether you use your eye consciousness. If you move the eye, and the object also moves, so it's a sign that's that consciousness involved, right? So to break that, the danger comes when you focus too much on an outer image, right? So one focus on an outer image, and then, you know, one tries to see it in front of oneself, because one has used the eye consciousness to look at the image. Right? So the eye consciousness keeps on looking at the image. That's why I said it's easier if you look at the image and then you build it up with your mental consciousness instead of looking there and looking up and keeping it. Right? Because there the danger would be to use the same visual consciousness that you used to look at it, then you simply, you know, bring it up. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, the idea, what I would suggest is you get acquainted due to the image of how it looks like, but then you build it up with your mind, you know, and you hold that, kind of like that. Or, for example, you see, if you remember your mom or somebody, you know, that's a mental image, because at that moment you don't look at the picture of your mom and you look it up. Right? So that's a mental image. So if, you know, you go back home and you try to remember how the statues look in the Gompa, then that would be a mental image. Right? But if you look at something with your eye consciousness and straight want to reproduce it, then there's a chance of involving the eye consciousness.
Venerable, could I please ask you, if someone has a cold, for instance, or has a problem swallowing, mm-hmm. or, you know, the flu, mm-hmm. and finds it difficult to meditate, like, for instance, me sometimes, like, I keep wanting to swallow at certain times. Sometimes I could meditate for an hour. Would it be okay to say mantras, or what suggestion would you have? And I just want to know, and I'm just for curiosity, when yogis go into deep meditation, mm-hmm. do they swallow it all? I mean, they go into the death trance, don't they? Mm-hmm. I'm not trying mm-hmm. to be mm-hmm. funny, but mm-hmm. I'm just curious. What mm-hmm. is your, would you have advice
well,
on swallowing?
That's why they say, you know, the position of the tongue is to go against the upper palate behind the front teeth. That prevents saliva from arising. So it blocks the creation of saliva, you know.
And how about if you have a cold or a flu and you're just...
Yeah, hopefully you don't have the flu the whole year. You know.
But, well, at least sometimes it could be for several weeks.
Yes, you can't even breathe.
Or
yes. It's definitely it's a problem for certain type of meditation. But one can meditate with open mouth, you know. So myself, when I have a cold, you know, it just happened that I opened my mouth because my nose is blocked. And then I put drops in my nose, and that helps. But there are periods, you know, you just do other practice, other meditation. You don't do calm abiding when... But at certain point, I don't know. It's the mind that meditates, so the body, you don't notice so much. No? Yeah, the body, you know, you might swallowing a few times, but it doesn't really disturb the mind, no? Because you focused on the mind. So, for example, I can do calm abiding meditation and actually move my body, move my leg, you know. For example, I sit on a chair, on the floor, then I sit on a chair. So I can actually move very slowly onto the chair and it doesn't disturb me from my meditative state. Right? So if I move very gently, you know, or, you know, you have pain in the knee, so, you move a little bit and you stay in meditation. And you just continue, you know. So it's really that, you know, if you go about it gently, there's no, yeah. And also swallowing, I mean, you know, one swallows, you know. I mean, it's okay, you know. I mean, no big deal.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm meditating on the Buddha, some minor, like, little obstacle that I feel conflicted about. This is very strange. So I'm quite sure that, like, when the Indian, you know, saints brought Buddhism to Tibet, the images that they brought of the Buddha did not look like the Tibetan Buddha that we see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, and I understand this is a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, like, it helps me to think... And I don't know if I'm okay, if it's okay to do this, to change the image. The face of the Buddha is kind of a multicultural face, kind mm-hmm. of to reflect the reality that we live in. So, like, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit African, a little bit Asian, a little bit mm-hmm. European.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yes and no. Right? Yes, so, I mean, certain aspects. You see, the Buddha we try to visualize is not the Nirmanakaya aspect, it's not the physical Buddha. It's the Buddha that lives in the Pure Land, you know, the 16-year-old enlightened form that we try to develop. So each characteristics of the body is a result of some spiritual realization. You know, so each aspect of the Buddha has actually a symbolic meaning of a spiritual realization. Is not really a physical thing. So it has that aspect. But in terms of calm abiding, you can visualize the Buddha as however you like. You know, if you if you prefer a black Buddha or blue Buddha or green Buddha, you know, it doesn't really matter. No. So, you see, and it's true, you know, if you look, you see, this art of Buddha that you have here is Gandharva art, you know. So this was created, I think, maybe 9th or 10th century. You can see a great Greek influence, right? So the Gandharva art was a mix, because in that age, I think Alexander the Great came to India. Alexander the Great, you know, invaded what nowadays Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and northern India, right? So there the art, you see, was very much influenced by Greek art, right? I like very much those art myself, you know. But it's basically, it was image of the of the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha, you know, the physical representation of the Buddha. Whereas in Tibetan Buddhism, we tend not to focus on that living Buddha. You know, in the Theravada tradition, one focuses on the historical Buddha. In the Mahayana, one focuses on the, let's clarify that. I think it's an important point. Because many confusions happen when people learn Tibetan Buddhism. You see, so you have the historical Buddha, the person that lived in India 2,500 years ago. So he was born in a Brahmin family, in a Kshatriya family, I think. So he was, you know, he was brought up to become a ruler, things like that. And he left home, you know, did ascetic practice for 6 years, then reached enlightenment, and the rest of his life he taught in India. And when he passed away, he passed into Nirvana. You know, he disappeared. You know, that's the Theravada, what they focus on the Buddha, right? The Mahayana, they focus on another aspect of the same story. They said the Buddha was already enlightened before coming. You know, he became enlightened countless ages ago, and in the Pure Land, there's these Buddhas that come at specific time to create a world religion when the times are ready. So they manifest as a human being, and they play the role of growing up, leaving home, you know, entering spiritual practice and reaching enlightenment and teaching others. And then when they die, again they go back to the Pure Lands. Right? So, and from that perspective, in this fortunate eon, there are 1,000 Buddhas to come. So Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth of this fortunate eon, because it's considered fortunate because there are going to be 1,000 during this time. But the other eons have less Buddha that will come. Okay? So, and Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth, and Maitreya Buddha would be the fifth. Right, and there are thousands. So it's explained in some scripture, it explains, you know, these things, right? So from that perspective, the Buddha we focus on is more the Buddha, the eternal Buddha that lives in the Pure Land, in his, you know, kind of like that. And then they manifest, you know, and we get teaching, things like that. And each Buddha's teaching lasts for a certain amount of time and disappears. And then there's a period of no teachings, and then another Buddha comes, you know, like that. Okay, so that's the Mahayana way of focusing on the Buddha. So when we pray to the Buddha, it's a mixture of these two. You see, there's the historical Buddha, but at the same time, there's this archetypal Buddha, you know, that lives in the Pure Land. Okay, and then there's a third aspect in Tantra. So in Tantra, you don't focus on the historical Buddha, you don't focus on the Buddha that lives in the Pure Land, you focus on the archetype of the enlightened state. How to express that? You see, there's no Buddha, you know, that exists like Yamantaka or Guhya Samaja. You know, they don't have 34 arms and 16 legs and, you know, four face in all directions, things like that. This is a symbolic language. Each, you see, having three face means that they are aware of past, present and future. Right? So having four arms symbolizes the four doors to liberation. So each aspect of Buddha's body is a meditation on the spiritual path. Right? So yogi visualize that, and then of focusing on the different aspect, it awakens in him, you know, spiritual realization. So for example, many deities have hold a vajra and a bell. So the bell symbolized the sound of emptiness, because in order for the bell to ring, it needs two things: in the clinger and the bell, right? It's by the coming of these two together that the sound is produced. So the sound is dependent rising. It's empty of inherent existence. You can have only the sound by the coming of together of these two things. Right? So a yogi, you know, when he sees a bell, he meditates on that, so it reminds him of emptiness. Right? And the thunderbolt, the diamond, symbolize bliss. You know, so it's unshakable. You see, it's kind of unmovable, like diamond. You know, so each feature, each ornament that they hold are an object of meditation. You see, so it's not that the being actually exists like that. The Buddha manifests as this archetype, and then if you meditate on that, it awakens in you this and that quality. Right? So, and these three levels in Tibetan Buddhism are inseparable, you know, they're constantly mixed with each other. So you focus mostly on the Mahayana aspect or the Vajrayana aspect, based on the foundation of the historical Buddha, right? Whereas, for example, in the Theravada tradition, you will only focus on the historical Buddha, right? Like that. So it takes a while it seems complicated, and it seems, you know, where I'm dancing here. But actually, after a while, you know, it actually makes sense. You see, if you understand that the tantric image is archetype, you know, for us, for those which have studied it a bit, Jungian psychology, you know, knows what an archetype is. It's basically a symbol, you know, a symbol of enlightenment, you know. Yeah.
My question is a lot simpler than that. I find myself, as soon as I try to partially close my eyes or that I'll start with a figure, and then the next thing I know, I've taken a little nap.
Yes.
And I've woken up.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And I really struggle with that.
Yes.
It's so relaxed.
Yes. Yes.
Before I know it, I'm waking up. So I don't know what to do about that. You talked earlier about things.
Yes.
Bright lights, but I wonder if I need to just meditate with my eyes open all the time.
You see, this is a problem many beginner meditators have. I had that too. It's because the only moment that we are used to actually close our eye is when we fall asleep. So the habit is there. So as soon as you close your eye, the mind goes there because that's what it knows. Right? It's not used to meditate, you know, it's not used to have the eyes closed or to look inside, because when it looks inside, it's to fall asleep. That's the habit it has, right? So it takes a while to break that habit, you know. So actually sitting and meditating with the eyes open can be helpful, you know, definitely. And actually just preventing being aware that that's what it wants to do, and preventing from happening. So better not to meditate just when you wake up or when you're very tired, you know, at the beginning, because, you know, the tendency is there, right? No.
I kind of hesitate to ask this question because I'm not quite... because I'm not quite sure... I hesitate to ask the question because I'm not quite sure if I'm going to be clear or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been thinking about it, and I feel like, well, maybe it can jumpstart something in my mind, even though the question may not be clear. So please forgive me. But... it seems like I heard somewhere in our studies, that it's through concentration. That's the, like the final stage or final step to the attainment of wisdom. I'm not sure if that's true or not, if I heard that correctly. That's why I'm a little hazy about this, because I'm not quite sure. If that's true, that is through concentration that we can attain wisdom, then where does visualization and analytical meditation, where does that fall in area of importance?
Mm. So I wanted to speak about that in the next session, but since you brought it up now, I might say a few. Yeah, just simply, so there's many things to realize on the path, right? So it's true what you say, normally based on calm abiding, then comes special insight, right? So the base of a serenely stilled mind, you need that in order to inquire into ultimate reality and to experience it. That doesn't mean you cannot experience it like we just meditated before, but you cannot experience it in a stable, deep, irreversible way, right? We can get glimpses from time to time, but it's not stable, right? So you need a mind of calm abiding, then to focus on emptiness, and then experience it very deeply, you know. Yes, so that's true, you know. But there are other things that one needs to realize. Right? You see, if you're not disappointed with cyclic existence, if you don't realize that pleasure have a frustrating nature, you keep on looking for them, and you won't have the stability of life that will help you to get calm abiding, you know? Because you will always be distracted by the things of this life, right? So it needs analytical meditation on the problems of cyclic existence so that, you know, one loses all one's interest in it, you know, and is able to give up, you know, watching TV, doing this and that, which on activity we waste a lot of time. And in order for that to become important, we have to realize that life is precious. That's a unique opportunity. We take it for granted because there are 6 billion people on this planet. But do they have a precious human life? You know, you look all the conditions that are needed to be precious. No, they are humans, but they don't have a precious human life. Right? Because precious in this context means that they have all the conditions to get great spiritual progress in this life. You know, but in order to do so, you need to have enough food, enough drink, have place to live. You know, if you live in a war zone, you cannot meditate very much, you know, you're in a survival mode, right? So you need a certain lifestyle, you know, that allows spiritual progress. Then if you realize that that is rare, and that this doesn't come about easily, you realize that, wow, I have something precious and I should use it. Right? Then you say, okay, I have precious, I'll use it. But then you think, okay, you know, maybe in 20 years, in 30 years, I'm going to do something about it when I retire. Right? But are you going to live that long? There's no guarantee. Right? Then you meditate on impermanence and death, how death can happen any moment. Right? And then suddenly it makes you a cold shower. You know, wow, when you have that realization, you say, well, there's no time to lose because, you know, people around me have heart attacks and this and that, right? So it could happen to me, you know? So you see these analytical meditation help you. They are very important because they give you some insight, some profound experience that makes you not waste your life. To gain Shinen and realize emptiness, right? So they are very important, you know. And if you have them, when you meditate on calm abiding, they're helpful. That's why Lama Tsongkhapa teaches calm abiding at the end of the Lamrim. You see, there's a reason he says why in his Lamrim Chemo. He says, I do that like that, because if you have the realization of the Lamrim, Shine comes very quickly. You see, what are our main distractions? You know, we think about food, the leisure we could do, all these distracting thoughts you don't have if you have renunciation, if you have these other, you know. You see, let's say, oh, I'm going to stop for a cup of tea. You know, say, well, I could die before the cup of tea is finished. You know, you stay on your cushion. If you have that habit of meditating on impermanence and you really realize that you could die any moment, then suddenly you meditate much differently. You make much longer session, you're much less tired, you're much less giving to your, you know, you wanting to go to sleep or wanting to go for a walk, because, you know, you could die. You know? So if that is, you see, we know it because we heard the teaching, so we know it with the head, but we don't know it with the heart, right? So there's different stage of realization of impermanence with anything. First you have the hearing, but then you have to contemplate, and that's what we don't do. You see, we Westerners have a problem. We hear and we think we know because we have heard. Right? But from hearing, normally, that meditation, you have to repeat every day for 3-4 weeks. And for 3-4 weeks, you go through the stages. You know, life is sure I'm going to die. Everybody has to die, you know. There's no guarantee any length of time on this planet, right? And it can happen any time, right? And then at the time of death, nothing else than my spiritual realization will be of any use. You know, my body, my friends, my possession, useless. So once you go to these stages for 3-4 weeks every day, you know, you spend an hour on it. From the intellect, it slowly sinks into your heart, and then it becomes yours, right? Then that's an. So it says first, you see, when you go to teaching and you hear about teaching about impermanence, and as an example, right? It could be any of the other things. So that's called an airy realization. It's a realization that comes due to the presence of a teacher that very eloquently presents you the topic, and you say, "Wow, that's true," you know. If you leave it at that, you go out 3-4 days later, you know, it hasn't changed at all your behavior or your activity, nothing. You know, it was just an instant where you got it, but you forgot it. So then you have to repeat that meditation again and again, right? So at the beginning you can get to that same state of mind, wow, this is precious. I could exhale and not inhale again and I would be dead. Right now, I exhale, I don't inhale, it's finished. So it's not in 20, 30 years, it could happen any moment. Right? So you get there by going through the stages of the meditation and you get to that point. And then you stop analytical meditation and you make single point in meditation on that experience. Wow! I could die. And you stay there. Right? So you do calm abiding on that feel, that experience. Right? And then next day you do again. So you go through the stage till you get to that point, wow, I could die. And then after 2-3 weeks you can go faster, faster. You don't need to go to all the detailed point to get there. You see, you can just jump stages. And after 3-4 weeks or a month, just thinking impermanence and death, you can be, wow. That's the effortless realization of that point. Right? Then it's yours. Then you just every day remember for 5 minutes impermanence and death and wow. And that has such a profound impact that it changes all your way of living. You know, your priority in life, everything changes because you realize, wow, you know, tomorrow might not exist at all. I make all these plans about my old age, my retirement, my pension and this and that, fixing my car, and it might never happen. Then your priority completely changes. You see, your spiritual life becomes the center core of your life and the other thing becomes the peripheral. You know? And then the spiritual path is, boom, a rocket, you know. It's just we don't have this realization. You know, the basic realization of the preciousness of human lives, impermanent death, we don't have. Yet we know it intellectually. We heard 100,000 teaching. We have read about it again and again. You see, it's not a, it's an intellectual knowledge, but not a realization. You see? So that's why, you see, one has to go through these stages at some point. So when one makes a retreat, a Lamrim retreat, one goes, you see, one stick with one topic for weeks till one has that realization. And then only we move to the... That's how it's supposed to be done. You know? So, and that you don't need to go into a retreat in the mountain, you can do it at home. Right? So the idea is, you see, you take, you know, you sit down and you do a prayer like the one we did. So it's a seven limb prayer. There's countless, you know, some do the Lama Chopa, some do Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, or any, you know, what your teacher, you know, usually does. And so one does this seven limb prayer, and then one absorbs the guru, and then one does some shine, calm abiding. You know, so you train. So that's to purify, accumulate merit, to create the minds, right? So you do some calm abiding. And then when the calm abiding is physic, you can either read the Lamrim prayer to say the old stage of the path, or there you go, you take up one of the Lamrim book, and you read that section on which you are. You know, precious. You start with precious human rebirth, you know, you read it, you reflect, you contemplate, you think about it. Till you get to that state of experience. Wow, this life is precious. You know, so unique. And I didn't have it many times before, you know. And I might lose it, and there's no guarantee I will ever get it again. You know, so many conditions have come together. You know, I myself often think, you know, if I die now, even if I had the choice to choose where I would take rebirth, my goodness, where would I like to go? You know? I mean, would I want to become a Tibetan refugee? Ooh. You know, in the West, there's so many distractions. You can go into sport at college. You can go into, you know, music. You can go into so many things, you know, that can sidetrack you. Or you're good at business, or, you know. I mean, there's so many options in life, you know. How come then in this life I have interest in spirituality? I don't know. Amazing, you know, so many options. So, you know, and then you say, well, now I have it. You know, I have all this condition. Now is the time to use it, to go as far as possible. Because tomorrow or next life, you know, maybe, but maybe not. You know? So, you know, so that's what the realization of precious human rebirth, you know? So then you, from becoming, instead of spirituality becoming a hobby, you know, it becomes really the central core of your life. You know? So it sounds very simple, precious human rebirth, but it's very, very profound when you get it, you know? And that's, you see, you start with that and you build up one realization after the other. Then when you get to shine, very easy, because you have all that background, you know? And it has so much changed your life that, you know, you committed, you know, like that. Okay, so maybe we do a 5-minute break. Okay, so be last session a bit short because I think it finishes at 3 or around 3. So yeah, so we'll have a break at 3 or so. So those which like to leave, they're welcome, you know. I'll like to stay and do a Metsin Buddha Puja after. So those which like to join me, they're welcome to stay, and those who want to leave, they're welcome to leave. So we'll have maybe 15-20 minutes break for us to arrange, and then we'll have a Metsin Buddha Puja for those who like and have the time. And for the other one, you know, the session will end at the end of this session. You see, the Metsin Buddha are these Buddhas from the second category of Buddhas I mentioned, you know, the one living in the Pure Lands. So they promise, they made prayers. You see, when they were drinking tea in the Pure Land, and they had to decide which Buddha comes down in this degenerate time, nobody wanted to go. You know, they're too degenerate, you know, no way. Their lifespan is too short, you know. There are times where we live thousands of years. Now, maximum 100 years. What can you achieve in 100 years, you know? So the Buddha said, you know, that, you know, these people, they live too short, you know. They have too many mental affliction, you know. They have too much desire, attachment, anger, pride, you know. The mind is too worried, you know. And then on top of that, there's a lot of war and problems in the world, you know. It's too difficult for them to get anywhere, you know. And but the Buddha, Shakyamuni, had so much compassion. No, I'm going to help specifically these beings of this degenerate time, you know. And then the Metsin Buddha said, oh, okay, so you're going. So we're going to help at the end of your teaching, you know, when the times are so degenerate, you know, whoever prays, you know, we're going to help them. So the Metsin Buddha consider very, have a special connection to our time because of the promise and the vows they have taken. You know, like it says in the sutra, in the puja, you know, you remind the Buddhas of the vows they have taken. You know, you say, look, you said that you're going to help me, you know, so you know, please, don't forget, you know. You know, like that you remember their vows. So there's a special blessing coming from the Metsin Buddha, you know. So if one recite their name 7 times, definitely it helps, you know. It appeases your mind, it helps you discover the pure clarity, peaceful nature of your own mind. You know, so it's very, very, very helpful. I like to do a lot this practice. Very helpful. So, in that sense, you know, for those which have time and wish to join in, they're welcome. And I personally, you know, each teacher has his own way of doing, so I add a little bit of shine in there, you know, kind of like that. So I have my own way of doing. So, yeah, that. So now I think, you know, some of you are old students of the center, some of you are fairly new. And I know, you know, from the question that some people go a little bit around here and there. So I would like just to say in a few words, because there's so many spiritual traditions and so many types of Buddhism. So in the Gelupa, there's a, you know, each spiritual tradition has its own methodology. His own way of doing, right? So the Gelupa way of doing it is the heart of the path is to study, to get the realization of the Lam Rim. You know, start with how to relate to spiritual teacher, precious human rebirth, impermanence, and that's karma and so forth. So you see, you don't go just to teaching, you know, because if you just go to teaching, well, it's always the same, you know? And then what happens, you become thick-skulled, as they say, you know. Basically, you hear the teaching and say, why should I go to the teaching? I heard that already 10 times. You know, why should I hear it an 11th time? It hasn't benefited me for 10 times, so why should it benefit me the 11th? You know? So, the problem is that we don't do it properly. That's where the problem arises. You see, we go to the teachings, but then we don't do the analytical meditation at home. You see, we don't do a guru yoga, a little bit of shine, and then contemplate and get the realization, right? Because You see, old geshe, they are 80 years old. They're older, they still go to the teachings. But they hear it from an you see, if you work on getting the experience, each time you go to the teaching is a different teaching. Each time you heard is slightly different. Not because necessarily the teaching is different, but you have changed level and you you hear it at a different level of your own experience. Right? So it's very important, because you see, if you don't do that inner work, you reach a point where you get tired of the teaching. You know, say, oh, it doesn't work for me. You know, but it's not that the teachings are wrong, it's the way we approached it that wasn't correct. You know, so it's very important to work, at least in this tradition. You know, you go to a Zen center, a Theravada center, they have a different methodology, it's a different picture. You know, but in this tradition, there's this graduate path to enlightenment, like explaining the Lama Imchemo. So the Lama Imchemo has three volumes. So to start there might be a bit overwhelming. So it's better to start with, to get an overview, you start with short Lama Im, like the Path to Bliss by His Holiness Dalai Lama. You know, so it's a small book like that that explains all this meditation, and actually His Holiness the 14th Lama is very good in the sense that he lives in this present age, so he knows the problems that arise in meditation. You know, for you know, the doubts or questions that arise for a 21st century person. You know, so the Path to Bliss is an excellent one. You know, I like very much that text. You know, as a short introduction for all the point of the Lama Rim. So it's a based on a teaching he gave at some point in. And then another one from His Holiness, the Essence of Refined Gold, also is a Lama Rim, is a teaching he gave as a commentary to the lines of experience from the from Lama Tsongkhapa. So these are good starting point to understand the Gelupa structure, you know, to understand the Lama Rim. And then for those which have the time and the leisure, you know, for example, the Geshe, the resident teacher, he teaches the Lama Rim Chemo, you know, so the great stages of the path. So it's good if one can come there, because, you know, you go to teaching, then if you don't understand something, he's there so you can ask questions, you can clarify your doubt, you can clarify the point you don't understand. So your understanding then becomes very clear, and you feel that, oh, I really understand what is meant by this point. And then if that text, you know, you still have doubt, then there's the commentary by Geshe Zopa, you know, this commentary on that is very clear. Like that. And if that's too big, there's another text that is what Lama Tsongkhapa wrote, is the Middle Lama Rim, you see, which is shorter, which just, it doesn't show all the quotes from the scriptures to prove that what he says comes from the Buddha, and that's how, you know, the Lama Rim Chemo, he brings the quotes from the sutras, you know, for where the Buddha actually explained these things. So it gives you the confidence that what he says wasn't invented by himself, Lama Tsongkhapa, it was actually what the Buddha taught, right? But in the Middle Lama Rim, he takes away all this quote, he just explains you how to meditate on it, right? And if that's, and as a blueprint of that, you have the Hymns of Experience, right? Or what's another? Song of Experience? Songs of Experience, yes. So that's the shortest version, you know, in the form of a poem or as a reminder of all the stages of the path. And there's many other texts like that, but those are the main one. So if one wants really to make progress, it's good to go like that, you know. If one wants just to put imprint, it's okay just to come to teachings and make a little bit of prayers, you know, a little bit of meditation. It's okay. One puts imprint, you know, but you won't get very far that way, you know. If you're really committed, you do it the way it's taught, you know, then really great transformation can happen in his life, even in his 21st, even, you know, within 5-10 years, you can get incredible realization, you know, if you do it properly, you know. And I think you have incredible conditions here because you have a nice gompa, nice group of people, you know, and you have a nice teacher. So you have all the conditions here together, you know. So it's just a matter of yourself, you know, putting your life together to make it work. You know? In one of the texts in the Pabongka Rinpoche, Liberation of Palm of Your Hand, at the end is an appendix which explains how to meditate on each point of the Lam Rim and the sign of realization of that point of the Lam Rim. You know, when do you know that you have the realization of precious human rebirth? When you know you have the realization of impermanence and death? When you know that you have the realization, you know, of refuge and so forth? And he explains how to go about it. So myself, I had the chance to receive teaching on that by Geshe Tekchok at Nalanda. So I would advise you to ask your Geshe, you know, that teachings on how to gain the realization of the Lam Rim. You know, it's a short text, but it's very, very clear, you know, then you know yourself, you know, oh, I have that realization, you know, now I can move to the next, you know, like that. So it structures you, you know. And then I think it's good if you could add a session, you know, in your schedule of coming here and just have a session of just sitting together. You know, like in the Zen center, like in a Theravada center. You see, there's a difference if you sit alone at home or if you sit together with other people. So to have... I remember when I was in Bodh Gaya, I used to go every morning to the Zen center. So you enter... You know, this may be a minute of prayer, and then you just sit for an hour in silence together. And at half hour, you know, there's a little dong, and for 1 minute you can move your body, and then another ding, and you sit for another half hour, and you just sit together. And just the presence of other people in the room, you know, just sitting together has such a powerful effect on your mind, you know. And then individually, each one can meditate on whatever he wants, but you have the supportive condition of other people sitting with you, you know. So, you know, when you sit alone, it's like that. But if you have many people sitting around, you know, it's easier. Somehow you have better concentration, better meditation if you have many people still around you. So I would advise you to try to come together to decide which day could switch them.
We actually have silent meditation every morning from
7:30
to 8:30.
Oh, sorry. Fantastic. So it's fantastic. Very low attendance. Yes, yes. So I would advise, you know, to make the effort to try to come because I think it has a great benefit, you know, just sitting together. To put it in your, you know, schedule, I think it has a difference if you sit alone or whether you sit in group, right? So, in our tradition, because we have so diverse meditation, we have always the excuse, I have to do my own practice, you know. But you can come and sit together and do your own practice, you know. So in your head, you know, you do your own meditation, right? But you sit with others, so I think it has, you know, if one can, it really has great benefit. And that's how you build the sangha of people, you know, which, you see, your practice just goes deeper. You know, if you every day, you know, sit for an hour, or a few days a week, you know, that energy, you know, and also, how to say, in silence, when you sit in silence with the people around you, there's a kind of recognition of the people with whom you sit. You know, you don't need to know their life story, you don't need to know who they are, what they are, but there's a heartfelt, you know, something. You know them on a deeper level in the silence of your sitting, you know them. And you have a respect and admiration for them, for that sitting, you know. So I think it's very, very precious. So definitely it helps. You know, in the West we are so individualist that we forget, you know, and we always have an excuse. It's far, you know, I have to do my own thing and that we have other problems. But if you commit and then you do it for a while, you see the benefit you get from it, then, you know, you feel more encouraged. Yeah. Okay, I think that's it. So maybe a last sitting for 10 minutes. So we end with chanting the mantra of love and compassion. I have a little bit of different tune this time. I do the Nyingmapa way. So you just open your heart and you ride on the sound and you expand your heart.
Om Mani Padme Hum Hri. Om
Thank you.
Song ye shing.